The facts about North Korea's nukes today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. If there is a summit with North Korea, expect President Trump to turn up the heat on Pyongyang to get rid of its nukes. But the question is, what exactly have they got?
And the answer is that we believe they have somewhere sufficient highly enriched uranium and plutonium for perhaps 25 to 30 nuclear weapons.
We've got more details on that. Plus, staff members at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum have gotten close with the Holocaust survivors who volunteer there. But now many of those survivors are in their final years.
It's a challenge from a personal perspective for all of us because these are not just people that come to work every day. These are our family.
Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Back with you, and thanks to the magic of radio, I'm keeping my distance from you with my summer cold. Still, the work goes on, and not just here in the newsroom. There's big work apparently going on with preparations for the now back-on-again June 12th summit with North Korea. A top North Korean official will meet with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo this week in New York. We'll tell you more about General Kim Yong-chul later in the show. The Trump administration is sure to press the North Koreans hard to give up their nuclear weapons, and we got to wondering just what nuclear capabilities does Pyongyang have? Siegfried Hecker is a former director of the Los Alamos Weapons Laboratory in New Mexico. He's now a professor at Stanford University. First of all, can you give us a rundown of what North Korea's nuclear program looks like today, May 29th? What's in their arsenal?
So they have a threatening arsenal today. The way that we try to estimate it is how much bomb fuel do they have? That is plutonium and highly enriched uranium. And the answer is that we believe they have sufficient highly enriched uranium and plutonium for perhaps 25 to 30 nuclear weapons. We believe that with the six nuclear tests that they've actually conducted, that they could deliver those nuclear warheads in most likelihood to all of South Korea and all of Japan. I do not believe at this time they yet have the capability to put those warheads on an ICBM, an intercontinental ballistic missile, to reach the United States or, for that matter, Guam or Hawaii.
So if the estimate is North Korea has enough material for 25 to 30 nukes, how long do you estimate denuclearization is going to take? Because you're one of the few experts from the West who has actually visited the nuclear sites in North Korea.
Well, the way that I look at it is it took them 25 or so years to nuclearize, to get to the arsenal that I just described. So let me give you the bottom line up front. I've laid out a roadmap that says it probably would take on the order of 10 years, but that could stretch to 15 years if the politics don't work out. The reason for it being that long is it took a long time to be able to, first of all, do the three parts of what it takes for a nuclear arsenal. That is, first, to make the bomb fuel. That's plutonium, highly enriched uranium. That takes large number of facilities. Second, you have to be able to design and actually manufacture and test a bomb. And then third, you have to be able to deliver, and that's the missile part. So if you look at those components, we're talking about dozens of sites, many, many hundreds of buildings, and thousands of people. And to turn that around is going to take the sort of time frame that I just mentioned. In addition, the time frame will be largely determined as to whether the U.S. and North Korea can build sufficient trust that will allow North Korea to feel sufficiently comfortable in its security to be able to give up the nuclear weapons.
And I imagine that trust is really important when one side is saying we want full denuclearization and the other side says no.
That's correct. And so that's what the negotiations would have to be about. And, you know, it's clear the U.S. would like to have North Korea. The term that they've coined is CVID, complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization. Well, that's not the way the North Koreans see it. In terms of my discussions with them, a civilian nuclear program is extremely important to the North Korean, as is a civilian space program. And whether the United States would want to allow such a civilian program in the long term is one of the big questions. Those things will have to be resolved through negotiations, which by themselves will take a long time.
So what would you stress to U.S. officials who will be negotiating with North Korea? What would you tell them?
In my opinion, what's really important is that you go in, and even in that first meeting, that you lay out that denuclearization is the end goal. We're not going to be debating that. And that means demilitarization is the end goal. So we want you to get rid of the nuclear weapons program. We're willing to discuss the possibility of you keeping civilian program. And in fact, we're even willing to work with you cooperatively in order to be able to make that transition from a military to a civilian program. And that cooperative activity would actually then give us the best chance to be able to verify any final agreement. But you must go into the negotiation stage by saying denuclearization is the end goal, but we're willing to come up with a mechanism by which we roll back the program and then eventually eliminate.
Sigrid Hecker, former director of the Los Alamos Weapons Laboratory in New Mexico, now professor at Stanford. Thank you very much. This was really interesting.
Marco, it was my pleasure.
The U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum opened a quarter of a century ago. From the beginning, it's relied on Holocaust survivors to help educate visitors. But the number of survivors is dwindling, and now the museum is preparing for a future without them. From Washington, WAMU reporter Michaela Lefrak has our story.
At least once a week, Holocaust survivor Helena Lippman-Yasharov Peabody brushes her gray blonde hair and carefully applies her makeup. Then the 85-year-old makes the trip from her home in Maryland to the Holocaust Museum.
Every Thursday I'm at the desk over there, and they usually manage to get a group of kids to, you know, so I tell my story to them as well.
Peabody has been volunteering at the Holocaust Museum for more than 15 years. She works at the information desk in the lobby and also gives presentations to private groups. Like many survivors, she remembers the war in remarkable detail. There was the roundup of Jews in her Polish town, the hiding, the ghetto, the mass graves, the escape by train, and the bomb that took two of her fingers.
You don't forget those things, and I'm one of the last eyewitnesses.
Helena is part of a team of more than 80 survivors who volunteer at the museum. Often, the survivors who work at the information desk are the first people visitors speak to.
Well, hi there, welcome. Thank you for coming in.
Almost always the thing that people talk about that impacted them the most was an encounter with a survivor.
Diane Saltzman directs Survivor Affairs for the museum. She says survivors have been working with the institution since before it even opened.
They translate documents. They sit at a public space in the museum and engage with our visitors on a day-to-day basis. And some of them have taken our rather intensive tour guide training.
It's a well-oiled, mutually beneficial system. Since it opened in 1993, the museum's hosted more than 43 million visitors and worked with hundreds of survivors. But time is taking its toll. Saltzman says she's been to 80th, 90th, even 100th birthday parties for aging survivors.
So our oldest survivor who is still volunteering is 101. And it's a challenge from a personal perspective for all of us because these are not just people that come to work every day. These are our family.
So now the museum is trying to prepare for a world without them. And survivors want to make sure their stories are remembered, too. That's how, on a recent afternoon, I find myself in a windowless room in the basement of the Holocaust Museum.
Show on the road. We have lots of writing to look at.
Around 1 to 2 dozen survivors gather here each month for a writing workshop. Helena Peabody's here too. Before class, she checks in with the instructor, Maggie Peterson, about a piece she's been working on.
But I didn't know how far.
So you want to look at it in class?
Well, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Peterson says the goal is to help survivors communicate their stories without getting bogged down in all the little details.
It would begin with, like, my father was born in this town, and then they would try to tell everything in maybe 10 pages. The work that we've done is to try to expand on the stories because otherwise it's very much like just a timeline.
First, Peterson instructs the class to take 15 minutes to write down memories on a random subject. Today, she's picked the idea of matchmaking.
So just a start.
Then they take turns reading out loud.
After the war, the situation was the same.
Louis and I were always together.
I was 45 when I started dating my Bashar. That's Yiddish or Hebrew for soulmate or bride.
Peterson says for most of them, English is a second language. So even when they're writing about lighter subjects than the Holocaust, the very act of writing can be tough.
Everyone at this table came here as an immigrant, had the immigrant experience. So for a long time, they weren't writing about it, they weren't talking about it, they weren't talking about it.
Many of the pieces from the workshop are now posted on the Holocaust Museum's website. But despite the museum's efforts, the Holocaust is still fading from memory. A recent survey found that two-thirds of millennials do not know Auschwitz was a concentration camp, and 80% of Americans have not visited a Holocaust museum.
So keeping the lessons of the Holocaust relevant and reaching a global audience are two of our biggest challenges going forward.
Sarah Bloomfield is the museum's director. She says soon the museum plans to translate its website into more languages and launch more programs to study and prevent genocides. To do all that, it's embarked on an incredibly ambitious fundraising push. For her part, Helena Peabody says she's recently noticed an uptick in interest in her story.
Now it's very, very, very popular for some reason, because I think we're dying out so fast. So everybody wants to talk about it and to bear, you know, have somebody bear witness.
She's echoing another survivor, Elie Wiesel, who said those same words in his speech at the museum's dedication ceremony 25 years ago this year.
For the dead and the living, we must bear witness.
Wiesel died in 2016, but his words are engraved on one of the museum's granite walls, forever visible to all who choose to visit. For The World, Michaela Lafrak, Washington, D.C.
Since the end of World War II, Italy has gone through a lot of governments. But before you think of the latest Italian political crisis as just more of the same, think again. This crisis is really the result of a clash that many countries are experiencing these days, including ours, a clash between anti-establishment populist politicians and the old guard political elite. That and an election in March in Italy that left two very different populist forces, the League and the Five Star Movement, trying and failing to find a way forward. We called Gianni Riotta of the Italian daily La Stampa to get his take. Gianni, what is the cause of this crisis?
The cause of the crisis is the long and bitter wave of populism that is sweeping the Western world, from President Trump to Brexit. And they won the election. They won the election in March, but they failed to produce a government. So we are going to go to election during the summer for the first time in the Republican history.
As far as the fight between a Five Star and Northern League versus kind of everybody else, I mean, who's going to come out on top in the end?
You know, it's interesting because your listeners, that I assume are not devoting too much time to Italian politics, would assume that since they were forming a cabinet together, the Northern League and the Five Stars were close friends. Not at all. They ran a bitter campaign against each other. The Five Stars were saying, well, the Northern League is a light of Berlusconi, and Berlusconi is a psycho dwarf, and the psycho dwarf is the absolute evil of Italian politics.
Let me just back up a second. Did you just refer to Silvio Berlusconi, the former prime minister, as a psycho dwarf?
That's what the Five Stars would call him, the
That's
psycho
what they're calling.
Dwarf.
Okay.
That's what the founder of the Five Star, former comedian Beppe Grillo, we call him Psycho Dwarf. But the interesting point is that they were ready to form a government with the strict ally of the Psycho Dwarf. So it was a very bizarre political case.
Well, that's a new one. I got to say, a lot of this feels more like a political traffic jam in Rome than anything that kind of aligns the Italian narrative with the populism and nationalism of Brexit or the Trump narrative. Where do you feel like the Italian story really mirrors Trump and Brexit?
In the identity politics, there is a lot of, we don't want immigrants anymore. We want to be Italian. We are Italians. We want our own currency. They didn't tell us that the euro would be like this. We want to go back to the old ways. So it's identity politics and it's resentment with the economic crisis. During the economic crisis, Italy lost 1 million jobs, 10 points GDP. And people long for the 80s and the 90s, where the country had 5 weeks vacation, the economy was okay. People long for that.
Journalist Gianni Riotta with La Stampa, speaking with us from Rome. Gianni, good to have you on the program again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Later in the show, the Bollywood boys rank their all-time favorite movies. Stick around. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. I gotta say, it is pretty amazing to watch a giant global company like Starbucks just shut down stores across the U.S. to do racial sensitivity training with staff. You don't see that every day. But these issues are alive, every day across this country and across the world, and many of us just don't know how to tackle them.
Like, how do you report someone just not giving you the time of day? How do you report someone just being like, are you sure you know the answer?
That's from our podcast, Otherhood, from The World's Roopa Shenoy. Ever since the election of President Trump, Roopa has been documenting the surge in news about race, identity, and immigration. In the current episode of Otherhood, she takes a look at race in the public high school in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the same school, in fact, that my own kid attends. Roopa joins me now. So what happened, Roopa, that made you take a look at Cambridge's high school?
I'd actually been wanting to do something in schools for a long time because for a year there have been a surge of hate incidents everywhere, but particularly in schools. And then this past November, a video came out from a school across the river in Cambridge, and the video was essentially the Black Student Union kids taking turns, sitting behind a table, looking straight into the camera, and just telling very simple stories about microaggressions they observed or experienced in class.
I was in a class, and then we're talking about how slaves were being raped. The white student in the back of the class stood up and said, slaves can't be raped because they were property. My
first period. Yeah, this was a really powerful video. I saw it when it first came out. But there was a problem, wasn't there?
Yeah, because it really got to the heart of a basic tension in Cambridge. Because, I mean, it's the home of Harvard and MIT. It's known as a global intellectual hub.
It's a big blue bubble of diversity.
Yeah, it's super liberal. And people think that they're doing some things right. And so this really shook up a lot of people. And I have to give credit to the district. The superintendent let me come in and do this story when I got rejections from a lot of other districts across the country that had seen similar incidents. And the superintendent, Kenneth Saleem, told me, you know, we have to be vulnerable in order to grow.
So Damon Smith is the principal of Cambridge Rindgen Latin. He's right in the middle of this whole thing, right?
Yeah. So Damon Smith, he is Black, and he was really invested in what these kids were trying to do. He really believed in the message that they were trying to send, but he had seen the video, and he could see that the kids were describing things in such a way that you could put together who they were talking about. And so he had asked them if he could edit out some things. They thought that he was going to censor a lot. And so they started sharing it, and it spread really quickly before he could get to it. And he told me, like, really openly, you know, this made him really frustrated, really mad, because he didn't think that people would get the message. And he says that's what happened. As soon as it started spreading, he was getting complaints.
How can the school let this happen? It's slander. It's a number of things, right? Students being empowered too much, students not having the proper level of respect. How are you supporting this? If the students are putting this out, you must have supported it. Some of those teachers who were quote-unquote identified didn't have the opportunity to kind of say, well, here's my take on what happened. And so we have people who were like, see that? How could they malign this person who does A, B, and C, right? And that didn't bring them to the table.
Yeah, he was in a tough position. He tried to strike a balance, though.
Yeah, he sent out an email to the whole school community saying, we didn't approve of its distribution, and we don't approve of the parts in it that seem to identify teachers. And then about 20 minutes later, he went and met with the Black Student Union kids, and everyone involved describes that as a very angry, tense situation where people were actually pretty quiet because they were trying not to say anything that would make it worse.
You tried to speak with some of the white teachers that Damon Smith said had complained, right?
Yeah. And again, I have to give the district credit because I tried independently and they tried also to help me speak with these teachers to get their point of view. And they declined. So I got as close as I could, and I talked with the teachers' union president, Dan Monahan, who's white.
There's a culture of fear at the high school that teachers will be punished for doing things that they didn't intentionally do. A number of educators also feel that students have incredible power at the high school and that they're worried by that. So teachers feel powerless.
And how do the students feel?
Well, Juliette LaFleury, the student that we heard from earlier, she says that some of the Black Student Union kids were treated differently by some teachers, harshly. And some people questioned the facts of their stories. They asked if they were sure they'd interpreted the situation correctly Other people thought it was all the advisor to the Black Student Union, a teacher called Kevin Dua. And the kids say that they were terrified that Kevin Dua would leave.
It was just one of those things where we were like, okay, like, we're worried for you. And we hope that you don't end up having to leave because of us.
But Dua, having heard this podcast, never said he was going to leave. And Damon Smith, the principal, told you that Dua's job was safe. So you were kind of confused about why the kids were so convinced that Dua would take off.
Right. And so I kept asking, you know, why? Why are you so fearful? Why are you so worried? And in the end, it seems to come back to something that happened the year before. They had several teachers of color leave after going to the administration with some concerns about how educators of color are treated. And there was one teacher in particular that I feature in the podcast. Her name is Kim Parker. She's a Black woman with a PhD. And parents and teachers really rave about her. She teaches lower level English. And she says that kids of color would come to her and tell her about other teachers, white teachers, who did things that the kids perceived as discriminatory. And she didn't feel like she could do anything about it. And things kind of came to a head when she was assigned two young Black students who had a previous teacher who hadn't recommended them for honors English, even though Parker thought that these same students were very qualified for honors English.
I was concerned that this was not the first time that I'd heard this story, particularly about particular teachers, and that I thought that that was a pattern. And what happened is they closed the investigation and they told those teachers, and then those teachers went to my department head and also to the principal and sort of demanded that I apologize. And I didn't, because I believe the kids, and those kids are incredible. And if they were white, they would have been in an honors class. I just know it.
And soon after that, Parker left.
Yeah, and that's just the beginning of the story. I mean, the podcast has much, much more. That was just to give you a taste and show you like how these issues are happening everywhere and how much they're being struggled with. And I just want to leave with a quote from the principal who just expresses this.
We're not going to grow if we don't have some conflict and some struggle. And it's not going to be pretty, right? And we can't shy away from that. Right? If we could do this work and everybody be happy doing it, you got to question whether or not you're actually doing the work.
You know, Rupa, as evidence of my own white privilege, there was a lot in this podcast about Cambridge Region Latin I did not know, and my own kid goes there. So when all is said and done, what do you think the rest of us can learn from what has happened at this one high school?
Well, what stuck with me the most was what the superintendent said to me right at the beginning, which is, you know, we need to be vulnerable and not defensive in order to learn and grow. And then what the principal said, which is don't expect to get it right, you know, expect to get it wrong and expect it to be messy and hurtful and all that stuff. But know that this is the work that has to be done in order to get someplace.
And that brings us right back to Starbucks and what they're doing today. To hear that entire episode of Rupa's podcast, head to iTunes or however you get your podcast and search for Otherhood. It's been really interesting to watch the reaction to Rupa's story in Cambridge this week. There have been emails from the school to families, school assemblies, meetings, and the discussion is just beginning. And that is probably the case at Starbucks as well. I'm Marco Werman. For some people, Bollywood movies are like magic.
There's something for each family member to enjoy, whether it's the little kid or grandma or the mom or dad, whether it's action or comedy or romance. There's something for everybody to find enjoyable in the movie.
The Bollywood boys rank their favorites. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. We started the show today talking about what we know about North Korea's nukes program and what exactly is in their arsenal. So let's check in on what's happening on the diplomatic front to keep that arsenal from getting bigger or getting used. The main headline on the diplomacy today seems to be that a top North Korean official is scheduled to meet with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in New York City. That's according to the White House. It's being said they're hoping to resurrect the June 12th summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. I was curious to find out more about this North Korean official, whose name is Kim Yong-chol. Anki Panda is with the Federation of American Scientists and senior editor at The Diplomat. We called him up because he's also a North Korea expert.
Kim Yong-chol is an interesting character, and in any other year, we might not have expected him to be the first person North Korea would send to the United States for what certainly appears to be a high-level signal that the June 12th summit might be back on. Kim Yong-chol is currently the vice chairman of the Workers' Party of Korea's United Front Department, responsible for fomenting support for the country in South Korea, and he's primarily known for his involvement in inter-Korean affairs. For instance, he played an important role in the rapprochement we saw earlier between the two Koreas this year at the Pyeongchang Olympics.
He's also a lot older than Kim Jong-un. He's probably in his early 70s, I've seen. How does somebody survive in North Korea's inner circle for so long? Is he just a yes man?
Well, he was around during the tenure of Kim's father. He was someone reported to be trusted by Kim's father. Most infamously, Kim Yong-chol is reported to be the mastermind behind the 2010 attack by North Korea on a South Korean corvette, the Chonan, which killed 42 South Korean sailors. So that certainly makes him something of an unpopular figure in both South Korea and the United States. And indeed, he is personally designated under U.S. Treasury sanctions. Mm. So he likely had to have received an exception for that to make this trip over to the United States.
And in some ways, even more surprising, he's lasted this long because I also read that he's not very deferential and even snarky at times. What do we know of his personality?
That's true. I mean, reports on the personalities of individual North Korean leaders do need to be taken with a grain of salt. But Kim Yong-chol certainly does have a reputation for being prickly, for speaking straight, and even for making inappropriate remarks and jokes and encounters with South Korean officials. So that's something to watch for, I think, during his trip to the United States. Kim Yong-chol is not a diplomat, which is, again, one of the reasons why he would not have been the first person I'd have expected the North Koreans to send over. But he is accompanied by people with more knowledge of the U.S.-North Korea relationship. So that's not to say that Kim Yong-chol is entirely unprepared for this trip. Quite the contrary.
What kind of autonomy might he have in negotiations with Pompeo? I mean, just in terms of negotiating on behalf of Kim Jong-un.
I suspect he has very little autonomy. All of these officials are speaking from a single set of talking points. They know exactly where the red lines are on what North Korea will and will not give up, what it will and will not say. And I suspect that Kim Yong-chol is very well prepared in that regard to deal with the United States.
And what do you reckon General Kim will be hoping to get out of his meeting with Secretary of State Pompeo?
So at this juncture, we have a few separate processes running. One is the talks at the DMZ, led by the expert team of U.S. negotiators, led by former U.S. Special Representative for North Korea Policy, Sun Kim, dealing with the technical aspects of the agenda. We also have reports that there's a second team meeting in Singapore on the logistics. I see this move by the North Koreans sending a high-level envoy to the United States as effectively a way to decisively set the momentum back on track for the June 12th summit. I suspect that him and Pompeo will make sure that both sides are walking into this meeting with the right set of expectations. Conversely, there is a possibility that something happens at this meeting that simply takes us back to where we were on Thursday when President Trump canceled the summit, and that revolves around the issue of denuclearization. Mm-hmm. Kim Yong-chol is someone that I can imagine reiterating the message that North Korea has already made clear in its state media, that North Korea will not be coming to the June 12th summit with the intention of turning over its arsenal to Donald Trump. That's simply not what the North Koreans are willing to do. When they say denuclearization, they mean a very different process, one that effectively refers to global disarmament, if not bilateral arms control with the United States. So there is still a possibility that this process could be derailed. But the example I look to here is the 2000 visit by North Korea's then Vice Marshal to the United States, which actually paved the way for Madeleine Albright, who was then Secretary of State, to visit North Korea a few weeks later. The analog there, to me, is quite strong. This is the Kim Yong-chol becomes the second highest level North Korean official to ever visit the United States. So in my view, this does suggest the summit will likely end up happening.
Anki Panda, senior editor at The Diplomat magazine. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Absolutely. No problem. Thanks for having me on.
My Bollywood awakening happened about 20 years ago with a long-delayed discovery of singer Asha Bhosle. For Sean Baig and Sagar Shaikh, it also started with music.
I love you all! दोस्तों ना कोई मंजिल है ना कोई साथी है फिर भी निकल पड़ा हूं घर से.
The song was O Jaane Jaana from the 1998 Bollywood film Pyar Kiya To Darna Kiya. Sean and Sagar are both actors in LA. 2 years ago, they were hanging out and just started randomly talking about that song. That led to a deeper conversation about how much Bollywood used to mean to them when they were kids. That led to this podcast.
Welcome to the Bollywood Boys podcast.
We are your hosts.
He is Sean.
He is Sagar.
And we are the Bollywood Boys.
Oh, jaane jaana, dhoonde tujhe deewana, sapno mein roz aaye.
Sean and Sagar join me now. So, for the uninitiated, what do I need to know to appreciate Bollywood movies?
Sean, you want to take it?
Sure. This is Sean talking. To appreciate Bollywood movies, you just have to kind of leave all your expectations at the door in terms of what you would normally expect out of a film-watching experience. You're going to go on a three-hour, on average, thrill ride full of music and dancing, comedy and drama, laughing and crying, every emotion you could possibly experience all in one, and lots of pretty people and pretty colors.
So tell us your stories. I mean, I know from listening to some of your podcast, Bollywood Boys, that you kind of have complicated histories when it comes to watching and enjoying Bollywood.
This is Sagar speaking. I watched Bollywood a lot as a kid growing up in Houston. It was a really diverse area, and I had other people around me that I could share these interests with. And then I moved to San Antonio, and I became like the only brown kid in my school. So all of a sudden, I'm just trying to blend in as much as I can. And if Bollywood was something that I had to cut out so I can pick up another thing to relate to these other kids, then I was going to do it. So there was like 6 years where I didn't watch any Bollywood films, but instead I was like skating or riding bikes, watching like, I don't know, Mission Impossible and talking about that in school. And then it took, I think when I was in college, I started hanging out with more Indian or Pakistani people. And, you know, it just became the thing to do again.
And Sean, why did you lose interest in Bollywood when you were younger?
So I grew up on these movies, and there weren't a lot of other Indian or Pakistani kids in my school growing up. So for me, it was just something that I thought was lame or I was embarrassed of. It was just like something my parents made me watch. But I remember like secretly really loving them. And then I kind of separated myself from Bollywood altogether. And I would say in college, I became friends with other Indian and Pakistani kids who really did love Bollywood. And that's how I sort of got back into it.
I mean, it's kind of interesting that you both came back to Bollywood in college when you both kind of reconnected with these cultures and seemed to be less worried about what being an other means or what people might think.
This is Sagar.
Totally, yeah.
Accessibility to these movies is also an issue. I mean, I remember some years ago, if you wanted to watch Bollywood, you'd have to rent the VHS at a local specialty shop. Now you can watch it on Netflix.
Yes, absolutely. This is Sean. I mean, when we were kids, most of the movies that I saw were bootleg copies. And a lot of times the copy would pretty much just be some uncle sitting in the theater recording the screen. So it'd just be terrible quality. Every fifth line might be translated, and I only speak English, so I'd have to have my parents translate the whole movie for me. And now, Bollywood movies are available everywhere, on Netflix, on Amazon Prime, and a lot of times the big releases will be in mainstream movie theaters now, too. So it's definitely a lot easier.
Does that suggest that Bollywood is almost mainstream? Because like 2001, Lagan was nominated for an Oscar. A lot of people thought it might win. It didn't, but it did seem to be a kind of before and after moment.
Sure. Yeah, no, definitely. I say that was definitely a watershed moment for Bollywood. And yeah, I guess you could say it's mainstream nowadays. We're finding on the podcast that a good amount of the people who listen to it and will interact with us are not Indian or Pakistani. They are just fans of the movies and really connect with the stories.
What have you both learned about not just Bollywood, but also, you know, the cultures that feed the film industry in India, your own cultures? Have you discovered something about yourselves in producing this podcast?
That is a good question. This is Sagar. I have realized that a lot of Bollywood films are kind of a similar story. Like, they all have the same skeleton with different skin, and you just gotta really accept that. There are new ones lately that are coming out, like Queen and Thanuwed's Manu, that take a completely different narrative, and I love when Bollywood does that. And Dhobi Ghat, which is another one that we covered. Some of these films are just, like, straight-up art films. I love the direction that Bollywood is taking with some of these newer films.
It sounds like you're saying ignore the details and the plot, revel in the spectacle. That's my translation of what you just said. But what would be your advice to people who have never watched Bollywood on how to watch Bollywood?
Just sit back and enjoy. Because this is an experience like no other.
Yeah, I think that's a leads to a big thing that we've discovered through watching. One of Sagar and I's big critique of Bollywood when we were first starting the podcast is that a lot of times the movies will start off very happy and funny, and then about halfway through there's this wild shift in tone where somebody gets shot, somebody gets dropped off a cliff, something crazy happens, and the last like half of the movie is very melodramatic and sad, and then it all like comes to a head to this big happy resolution. We kept wondering, why is there this like constant crazy shift in tone in these movies? And then we learned when we had a guest on, Dhruv Singh, who's from Mumbai, India. He explained to us that Bollywood movies are really kind of made for the whole family to enjoy. So there's something for each family member to enjoy, whether it's the little kid or grandma or the mom or dad, whether it's action or comedy or romance. There's something for everybody to find enjoyable in the movie. And so that's what made sense to us more. And the fact that it's not just like a little popcorn flick for people to enjoy. In India, these are like events to go through. This is like a whole day thing to sit through with your family. So then we kind of understood, okay, that's why they're kind of set up like that. That's why there's that formula built into these movies of like every kind of genre thrown in at once.
And the total running time of some of these movies, I mean, 4 or 5 hours, not uncommon. So a whole day event, you're not kidding.
Yeah,
no, not at all.
This is Sagar. I think 4 or 5 hours is a little extra, but yeah, 3.5 hours is totally reasonable for a Bollywood film. And some of these movies do like have every single genre so well within the film. And these films are so great that they leave them in the theaters for 10, 15, 20. There's a film that's been in theaters for almost 25 years now.
Wow. What film is that?
Dilwale Dulhania Le Jayenge, which is objectively the greatest film of all time.
I agree. Yeah.
So if we were to watch one Bollywood movie and get hooked, like a gateway Bollywood flick, either old or new, what would you recommend?
I would probably say, this is Sean, I would probably say Dilwale Dulhania Le Jayenge. For me, it is kind of the platonic ideal of a Bollywood movie. So many of them are romances between two people who cannot be together for some reason, whether it's their families disapproving or they've come from two different classes. And this movie really captures that basic formula the best way, I think.
So I want to ask you one more thing. Each of your episodes of Bollywood Boys ends with this little number performed, I think, by you both.
Good night, 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 night. 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 I don't want to go.
What is the story behind that?
So this is okay. So there's a movie called Duplicate, and that is our version of one of the most popular songs in that movie. And the actual lyric, he just says, la 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 la. And it was Sean's idea. He just sang it like that one day. And I was like, oh my God, this is perfect. We got to have this as our footer.
Wow. For a couple of guys who drifted away from Bollywood, you are surely deep into it again.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Sean Begg and Sagar Sheikh are the Bollywood Boys of the Bollywood Boys podcast. Great to speak with you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you
so much. La 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 la
la la la la la la la la la. The Bollywood Boys with some of their favorite movies there. To see their list, come over to PRI.org. Hooray for the Riff Raff, great little band from New Orleans, fronted by musician Alinda Segarra, who's of Puerto Rican descent. Last year, Alinda and the band released a song, Palante. She was sending a clear message, a message of solidarity and support for the island of Puerto Rico. From El Barrio to Arecibo. From Marble Hill
goes to Emmett Till, Palante.
Palante translates as onwards or forward. It's easy to see how that applies to post-hurricane Puerto Rico. Also, if you go back in time, Palante was the title of a newspaper published by the Young Lords, a Puerto Rican leftist group advocating for social change in the 1970s. All of that is wrapped up in the message you get in the new Palante music video. The plot for the video, it's really more of a short film, unfolds in what looks like a ravaged yet recovering Puerto Rico. Director Christian Mercado Figueroa focuses his story on Milagros, a single mother grappling with raising her daughter in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. We'll hear from Figueroa in a moment. First, actress Mela Murder, who plays Milagros on screen. She says filming even a half year after the storm, it was impossible to ignore how devastated Puerto Rico was and remains today.
We landed really late. It was dark. There wasn't much people around, and all we were really surrounded by was the devastation. So in the beginning, I felt really tense and overwhelmed. And then we started meeting more locals in the area whose energies and spirits were so uplifted, so positive. And it really did just set the tone of how I carried myself.
Mela, what was your role in envisioning those scenes?
I wanted to just approach it in a way where it was respectful of all single mothers, but also the women of Puerto Rico. I met with many women, single mothers, so young, and to just be amongst such strength of women who you literally have to carry the load of themselves and their children by themselves in these conditions. It was so overwhelming, but so beautiful, and it really did set this standard of how I wanted to approach Milagros' character. I wanted her to have that strength, but then I wanted her to have that warmth and that vulnerability. And you see that in the moments where she's, you know, just laying in the bed and she's looking in the window and she's internalizing whatever she must have been, you know, feeling or going through that day.
I mean, that's what Palante is all about. And Palante, the word itself, it's a strong political and empowering sentiment. What does Palante mean for you?
Oh my God. I mean, I grew up with my mom being a single mother of three girls, a mother of three by the time she was 24. And she never really kind of instilled the specificness of it, like this attitude is Palante because we have to step forward. No, she just literally got on with it. And I watched my mother face domestic violence and verbal abuse, you know, from my father, and she never let those moments define her or break her down. And that really is what inspired me and what keeps me going as a single mother today.
It's interesting. Palante was kind of the cry of the Young Lords. And from that, you've taken this empowerment for single mothers.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it resonates with everything and everyone and any type of situation you may be in, you know, for a sense of hope. And I think it's very, very beautiful. It's a powerful message. And again, I'm just so humble and honored to have been able to be part of telling this story. It's very, very, very important to me.
It was a deeply personal experience for actress Mela Murder, as it was for the director of the Palante video. Christian Mercado Figueroa says focusing the short film on a single mother was very deliberate on his part.
I think like I focused a lot on the single mother experience because I come from a single mother family, and like Mela herself is a single mother. And
Mela's mother was a single mother.
And yeah, so there is like a feeling of a cyclical feeling there. But also I think like, yeah, I did think of Puerto Rico almost as a single mother somewhat. She's like kind of struggling the island, and like she needs support, but she's still strong and resilient.
It seems like that also extended and oozed into the filming of Palante. I mean, Mela said everybody seemed to have a pretty intense personal emotional experience during filming.
Having lost my grandfather in the aftermath of the hurricane due directly to the circumstances of the hurricane, you know, where, you know, without electricity and without communications, they couldn't really call an ambulance for him. He suffered from sleep apnea and wasn't receiving the therapy he needed. That helplessness was just like intense. And just kind of dealing with that with my family as a whole and the shared trauma of that and having them move so quickly to New York, you know, and like having them crammed into an apartment and how that brought us so close at the same time, even though it was in the wake of something so tragic. And, you know, I think like I would have intense experiences because I was going back to like places that I haven't seen in like 5 years. And, you know, my grandfather wasn't there. And, you know, that's when the absence started to become more real.
So as intense as it was for you, emotionally multi-layered intensity, being on the set sounds like it was oddly cathartic.
I never cried on set before, so that was just kind of like a discovery in itself. Mella, at some point when I went to my aunt's house, which was empty, you know, and had been vacated for like, you know, a long time, when I stepped in the house, I had the flush, that like this rush of memories, just like a bombardment of his veins, and I just broke down in tears, holding like my monitor. And then Mella kind of came up to me and just hugged me and just was like holding me and telling me, "You're strong. This is going to be beautiful. And, you know, you need to let those tears out." And my aunt came over and hugged me too. And it was just like a really crazy moment, I think. Like, it was just like, it felt really special being able to like express something. And I think a lot of people come away from the video saying that it feels beautiful, that it feels honest. And I think that a lot of that has to do with just having a very open process and letting the emotional toil of all the things that have been happening in my life kind of just, you know, take root and not try to hide from it.
That was Christian Mercado Figueroa, the director of the video for the song Palante by folk blues artist Hooray for the Riff Raff. We also heard from actress Mela Murder. Our story is part of Future Folk, our collaboration with Smithsonian Folkways. I leave you with a few more notes from the tune. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
Well, lately, it's been mighty hard to see. Just searching for my lost humanity. I look for you, my friend, but do you look for me?
PRI, Public Radio International.